Yeah, my name's Danny. I'm an alcoholic. And it's really a privilege and an honor to be here. And I look forward to, you know, sharing my experience, strength, and hope with you guys and gals for the four-week series. You know, my life is just amazing today, thanks to the recovery that I have found through the steps and continue to find, live the steps in my life today. My sobriety date is November 27, 1987, so I've been around for a while, and but I still have the same enthusiasm and for recovery as which I needed desperately then, but now it's just, I just love to be alive, and I love to be of service and help people. And actively try to tap into the spirit, which is a critical point of this program, no question about it. So tonight we're going to just really touch base on the first three steps. And for me, they are an essential point, as well as all steps. But if you don't really have a firm foundation in one and two, there's a good chance that you are setting yourself up for failure down the road, because I'm a firm believer in that, you know, obviously we have a disease that centers in our minds, and in many cases, we need to have a vital spiritual experience, a psychic change to occur, and, you know, we need to buy into that, and in many cases, you know, spiritual knowledge is just not enough, but before you could even get to that point, you know, I had to actually be, for me, like many of us, beaten to a pulp. So for anybody who knows my particular story, 25 years ago when I wound up in Graymore as a result of over 20 years of drinking and drugging and having lived in the streets of all of 1987, that was my final, hopefully, beating that I had to take. I had to be robbed of all self-sufficiency. Didn't really have to, but for whatever reason, that was the path I had taken. And it opened me up to be willing to digest the tremendous spiritual kit that was laid out before me. But I was unwilling to really be to do that for many years. You know, without going through a whole long thing, but, you know, I grew up in Woodside, Queens. You know, I had a typical Irish family. My father was 58 years old when I was born. So by the time I was like 10 or 12, he was already bedridden. He was an alcoholic, beat my mother, terrorized the house. To me, it just seemed like normal living. And then they sent me down to the nuns and who continued the beating. So, and in some cases, I probably deserved it for being a little wise guy. But not really at this the amount of beatings they gave us, so which they'd be arrested today. But back then, problem was you would get beat up in school, and then you go home and tell your parents, and then they'd beat you up again because you probably, they think you deserved it. So needless to say, for any understanding of a spiritual basis at that point, for me, was really useless. It just really was rammed down your throat, and I had no use for it other than go to school. And but I was into sports, and I was a good athlete all my life. I've always been a good athlete, and I got a lot of my self-worth from that. And I like to get high. So by the time I was 12, I was huffing Carboner, started huffing glue, and just was a little garbage head all through all my teenage years. Every weekend we would try something different than this and that, and we drank. You know, of course we drank, and that pretty much was the story. You know, I went to school. Looked forward to getting high. Why? Because I liked it. I didn't really feel I was running away from anything. You know, I just really liked to get high. I was like a space explorer. You know what I mean? I like to test things out. You know, I was in, and this was the 60s and 70s, so there was a lot of mind-altering things going on. So that's just the way it was. But you know what? I went about my life and you know, I went to school because I had to go to school and play sports. And as long as I could, you know, play sports, I felt everything was okay. I had no idea that I had been introduced to the rapacious creditor. You know, I found out later on what the rapacious creditor was. But at that particular point, I just thought social experience of getting high was a great way to just unwind and hang out and party. And you know what? There was a lot of good times with that too. But of course, I was also somewhat of a lot of trouble getting into juvenile stuff. I wound up getting arrested in a stolen car and things like that. And that was the normal stuff in my neighborhood. So I went through a lot of that through my teenage years. I did graduate from high school, played on all the sports teams, but I didn't go to college. Went down to Wall Street, and down there, my boss took me to the bar. And I was like, this is fantastic. So and I was a hustler. I really had the belief that I could succeed in anything I did. I really was a driven person. And the drinking wasn't really having the effect of destroying me, meaning like I could be drunk and still get up in the morning and go to work. So I didn't know anything about alcoholism or any of that type of stuff. I just thought this was the way life would always be. You know, you party. For me, sports, music, women, rock and roll, all of that thing, that's all I really cared about, you know? That's all I really cared about. Work, there was only one reason to work, and that was to get money to do drugs, to drink, to hang out and party, and that's how my life was, and that's how all my friends' lives were. I didn't understand, which I would eventually learn many, many years later, that in essence, I was buying into a false illusion that would eventually turn around and rob me of all my self, you know, sufficiency and just destroy me. I couldn't, at that particular point, I would never ever believe that that would happen to me because everything seemed fine. I got along with people. I was hanging out. I was partying and this and that. I was going to school. I was passing and I wasn't really excelling, but I didn't really want to excel. I just wanted to pass, okay? And then work, I really started working hard. And I started moving up the ladder down in the Wall Street area. So it was the early 70s, and I had no high school, no college, but it didn't matter. I was being promoted. And that went through all the years, many, many years. I did get involved in other things, you know, for me, you know, liquid things that kept me awake, per se. And it allowed me to drink more. I actually started becoming a chemist, you know, how to, like, get myself awake in the morning, put myself down at night, drink during the day. Had no idea of what alcoholism was, but I did know that by 10:30 in the morning, many times I was shaking, and I needed a drink, and a Bloody Mary would work. So I didn't know why, but I knew I needed one, and I would do that. So my life became a series of that. Now, I was also getting promoted, so there was a lot of things going on in my life, trying to maintain this, really a dual personality of, you know, keeping myself medicated. Now, there would be periods where I would stop and maybe not be always high and this and that, but it would always be coming back to eventually that type of stuff. And for me, you know, when I would go out on a Friday night, you know, the Hamptons were around, be out to the Hamptons. You know, I remember my mother used to say to me, "Where are you going?" And I'd say, "Out." And she'd say, "Where you going?" And I'd be out. And the truth of the matter is I didn't know where I was going because I never knew where I was going to end up. And eventually, it just went on and on and on, and it was wearing me down. I used to like to say, I still like to say it, in the beginning it seemed like 95% was fun, 5% was trouble. But that meter over the years started going. And then eventually it started to be like 50% trouble. You know, I could deal with that, you know, 50% trouble, 50% fun. It was still fun. And it was always, I could think of a reason why something was going wrong. If I just control this and, you know, not knowing that there was a lot of control going on, trying to keep myself in line. And then things were happening where people were saying to me, "Do you know what you said last night? Do you know what you did?" And I'd be like, "No, was it good? No, it wasn't good. You took a swing at somebody. You did something. You were argumentative. You know, wait till you see the boss." This was, and now the underlying fear was coming up inside, like, "Oh, geez, what's going on?" And I would try to figure, I could think through the blackout and figure it out. But, you know, I didn't know what a blackout was, you know, really, other than, I don't know, I just, this came with the territory. So that went on and on and on. And eventually what happened was I took a break from work. After 8 years, I got promoted. I took a break because it was becoming, it was becoming a hassle. I really didn't want to work anymore. So I became a bartender in the local tavern. I was in charge of the softball team, the foosball games, the dart teams, the And of course, I met my wife along the way and had three kids in 4 years, you know, following the Irish rhythm method. But it all became a big game to me, you know, the partying behind the bar. It was a local bar, so, you know, and telling my wife that part of the job requires as a bartender, you know, bartenders, I have to go when they're working, they have to come where I'm working, and it requires late hours and after hours, you know, and that's just what was going on. So we all know where that leads to, infidelities and this type of stuff. It really was becoming a disaster, and I just couldn't understand why she was getting pissed off. And she was. I was a bookmaker, we were on food stamps, and that's the type of life I was living. And I didn't think there was any problem, you know. I didn't think there was any problem. You know, I still believed everything was under control. But underneath, I kind of knew it wasn't. So eventually, I wound up going back to Wall Street. And while I was down at Wall Street, I hooked up a good job. I went on an interview. They hired me in a pretty good position. And I got back into the swing of Wall Street again. And I started doing okay. But still partying. You know, but not as crazy. You know, I could clean up good. But the alcohol was now creating some problems in my life, and of course I was having trouble at home with my wife, because now I was given cab vouchers. I was in charge of cab vouchers down at Wall Street, so I'd be in the parlor car and all the bars down there till whatever hours I could call for a cab. Would never know how I got home, but I'd get home. And so this was going on, and you know, she didn't appreciate that. So eventually what happened is we separated. You know, one of those, I'll show you, blah, 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 you know, blah, blah, blah. And I left her and moved back in with my mother. So, I'm just going to show her. So what happened now is my drinking started taking on a little bit more destructive type of drinking. I started drinking a lot of scotch now with not much water or ice. And it became knockout drinking. So, and this is what I started to do. I didn't know anything about AA still in my life. But this is what I was doing. I was knocking myself out. And then I was starting to pour me's, like, you know, because now my kids were mad at me and this and that. And I was going through this series of all this stuff. And it became, I had a very, very bad situation where, you know, I was drunk out of my mind. She started seeing some other guy and this and that. And I went over there and, you know, took the place down with a baseball bat. You know, I was losing control now of my life. And created some very, very emotional damage to them. It didn't hurt anybody, thank God. And at the first time in my life, I realized, you know what? I got a problem here. I got a problem. And I went to my first AA meeting. And I went to the meeting. I remember it was in Joan of Arc. And I heard the message, and I was like, you know what? I need to stop drinking, that's all. So I did, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days or whatever it was back then, and started feeling better. And called up my wife and said, you know, honey, you know, I'm doing good. I'd like to come home. And she was like, drop dead. You know, I don't want you. You're not coming home, man. So that was the only reason I came. And so I was back to the bar. And everybody, hey, back to the bar. And the merry-go-round started again. And just, you know, I could get it together a little bit. I still had a job. I was getting promoted. But I knew that there was problems going on. So I moved out, and I moved in with my a friend. A nice apartment and all that type of stuff. But I got a Saturday bartending gig. And that's when really, as bad as it had been already, it wasn't even close to how bad it was going to get. And so eventually what happened is I got involved with this girl who was a drug dealer. She introduced me to some other things. And now all of a sudden, I was always into instant gratification type of living. And she introduced me to something that created a lot of instant gratification that I kind of chased for like weeks, and I got involved with her, and so now all of a sudden I was living a life where I wasn't sleeping all that much, and I was drinking like crazy. I had a washer dryer in my apartment. I would actually, you know, do the laundry, put the clothes on the bed. I would take a shirt and just iron the front of the shirt, and put a suit jacket over it to go to work, and that was all I could do. And buttons were falling off. People are saying to me, what's wrong with you? You're losing weight. What's going on? I'm working out. That's what I'm doing. I'm working out. I'm doing good. So this is where I was. I was starting to lose my mind, okay, deteriorating. It was actually losing my mind. So I was supposed to pick her up to take my children, and I was weekend out. I was supposed to pick her up to take my children and her children off to a, we were going to go to Hershey, Pennsylvania, and again, she was a drug dealer. You know you got a problem, too, is when your girlfriend's a drug dealer and you go to a wedding. I went to the wedding of the bartender from the parlor club, so that's a symptom of a problem, that you're at the bar too much. And when I got home the next day, my drug dealing girlfriend says to me, "You have a problem. You know, you have a problem." Because I passed out in the middle of the wedding on the floor in the lobby. And she didn't think that was appropriate. So, because I was the type of person, I would do things to keep me awake, but I would drink like a fish. And then all of a sudden it would hit me and I would just be out cold. So eventually what happened was I was supposed to pick her up. She doesn't answer the phone. The police are outside the door. I think she gets arrested, blah, blah, blah. The buzz starts going around. I had just spoken to her. She said she was in trouble. I was concerned. And then it turns out we found out her roommate's husband, ex-husband, had come in and killed her and had shot her, shot the girlfriend, and killed himself in the apartment. So that sent me on another destructive poor me. You know, she got shot, but poor me, okay? And I literally now started just getting high, and my roommate moved out because I was out of control, and I just started deteriorating in more and more and more and more. And I had gone to, at that particular point, I finally collapsed and went to my EAP instructor in Merrill Lynch, told him I had a problem. And he said, "Yeah, you're an alcoholic." And I'm like, "I think I'm a drug addict, but that's okay." He says, "No, you're a Northern European, you're an alcoholic." And I was like, "All right, fine, I'm an alcoholic." And he sent me out to Brunswick House. And I went to a rehab, full pay, May, beautiful. So I'm out there and they finally pick up a book and start talking about the big book. And they start going through this, the disease concept, all this type of stuff. You can't pick up the first drink and this and that. And I'm like, I got it. I hear you. I'm not buying the book, but I hear you. Okay? I got it. Now, I didn't know eventually I would read the book and it would talk exactly what I was doing at that particular point, thinking that self-knowledge of my own disease would be enough for me to cure myself, that I could just say, "I understand the problem. I'm a smart guy. I'll be okay. And I'm just not going to pick up. I'm not going to pick up the first drink. Not going to happen. I don't need to read the book. I got it already. You know, send me the CDs. Okay? I'm not picking it up." So I left there, moved back home. And now in the meantime, you know, you forget all these things. I had gotten another girlfriend. This was a couple of months after the other one. It was really, you know, an abusive relationship that we like to get into when we're in those situations. And I was going to get her sober. We know the story. Okay, 3 weeks later, South Sea Seaport, I'm down there, have a glass of wine. I don't even like wine. I had a glass of wine. Next thing you know, I'm down in the corner looking for Flacco, and all hell breaks loose, and it's all over. Again, I am on a run now in work, getting high in my office, drinking, and I'm like a lunatic. I'm like paranoid. Everybody's after me, and this and that. So eventually what happened was January 1987, started bouncing checks for the first time in my life. I just eventually just got a bonus check from work and they told me, and I told myself, you know, I was talking to myself, so I can't have a job and I can't be an addict and an alcoholic at the same time. I have to get rid of one, so I figured let's get rid of the job. And so I just walked out of the job and just took off and headed to the streets. I was bouncing checks, you know, it's a million crazy stories in there, but out to the streets, and that's where I stayed all of 1987, just deteriorating, living on roofs, just deteriorating, stopped paying child support, stopped seeing my children, stopped doing all that type of stuff. Eventually, one of my friends had a van. I would help him do moving jobs. One of the guys left two air mattresses, and he said, "Do you want them?" I said, yeah, air mattress. This was happening to me now. My mind was deteriorating, and I actually said, "This is not that bad. I got an air mattress. I could live in the van. This is not that bad." This is what I was saying to myself. This is not that bad. And I did that for about a month, and then the city confiscated his van for parking tickets. And there goes my house. So I was like, this is unbelievable. So now I'm back to the roofs, finding places to sleep. So needless to say, eventually, end of the year, I had ripped off my mother, blah, blah, blah. There's a million crazy things in there. So I wound up going back to my mother, begging to let me in. November was coming around, I was freezing out. She said, you could come in for the night, but that's it. You got to go. And I wound up in a detox, and it was there that the journey started. So it was there. I had lost everything, completely wiped out, bankrupt, couldn't feed myself, couldn't clothe myself, had nothing. And I wound up in Graymore. And it was up in Graymore that I heard the, I was beaten, man. I was really beaten to a pulp, you know, demoralized, powerless, you know, just incomprehensible fears were going through my mind. How the hell did this happen to me? How the hell did I wind up here? You know, I was successful. What happened to me? And I didn't know. And I was scared out of my mind. And I went to one of their masses up there, and I heard a very, you know, this is my story. So there was a scriptural passage that they talked about Zacchaeus. He's up in a tree, and Jesus is walking down the lane. He stops. He looks up, says, Zacchaeus, come out of the tree. I want to enter into your home today. And I was hit with a wind. Just came right through me and, like, scared the hell out of me. Okay? I thought it was an acid kickback, but I wasn't sure. Now, I was rereading the book a little bit today, and even Bill Wilson had a little story about that where he was even a little startled when he had that. You know, to some people it comes gradually. Mine was sudden at first, okay? But that wasn't enough for me, okay? That was just a moment of clarity that, you know what, I will be okay if I'm willing to do what I need to do. So I got at that particular point, I mean, many people know, I spent 6 weeks, 7 weeks in Graymore. I went to a rehab for 6 months. I spent 9 months in a halfway house. And I devoured the program. I got into the book, reading the book. I started really understand what they were talking about now, that you have a disease that centers in your mind. Okay. Very, very important. Your first step is really where you accept the fact that you are hopeless. And that's how I felt. I'm hopeless. You know, I'm hopeless. And then they put out the branch. But, you know, you can recover. There is a way out. You must find a power greater than yourself. And I'm reading that. I went to the back, the spiritual experience talks about you must have a psychic change. It doesn't say you must have psychic knowledge. You must have a psychic change. So all I really was doing was analyzing what they were saying. It's really information. The first and second steps are really not they're really not action steps. They're really you're dwelling, you're thinking about this proposition. You know, and I always like to bring this out. In the original, how it works, okay, they get up to the point where they say, if you are not convinced on these vital issues, which are, okay, that no, you are alcoholic, cannot manage your own life, and I, you know, when you wind up in Graymore, it's not that hard to accept that maybe I'm out of control. So, but if you're somewhere in the middle right now, my experience tells me it always gets worse, it never gets better. So if you haven't hit that bottom, you don't have to, because I've already hit it for you, and so have a lot of other people. Then it tells you that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism. Okay, we need to buy into that. So that means I'm not going to get sober from you. It's got to be a power greater than myself. That's what the book says, and that's, believe me, that's what I'm selling here today. I'm selling what's in the book because it worked for me. Okay? And that God can and will. And then they say here, this is the original manuscript. If you are not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away. Okay? They told Bill that might be a little harsh. Let's take that out. But the truth of the matter is, if you get up to that point and you haven't bought into the fact that you are alcoholic, that you need to find a power greater than yourself, you're not going to want to do the rest of the steps because there's no need to do them. Because the purpose of the rest of the steps is to help you find that power that is greater than you. And the truth of the matter is what it's going to tell you, you know, as you read. Now, just remember, from the beginning all the way up to chapter 5, how many chapters do they spend on the first and second step? That's how important it is that you buy into these propositions. You must buy into these propositions. And the beauty thing is, once you do buy into these propositions, immediately you will feel a sense of relief. Even though you won't have had the change yet, but you'll feel better. And that's what happened to me up in Graymore, is that all of a sudden I knew that I was going to be okay. Okay, doesn't mean I don't have to do the work that's going to be required to clear away all the blocks that are in me that are preventing me from finding what they talk about on page 55, that in the final analysis that there is a power of God within you, and it is only there that you will find him. So the question we need to ask ourselves Why am I not finding that power that's within me? Okay? And I can tell you, 4, 5, and 6 will be the start of finding out why that power that is within you is blocked from you. Because it's there. Whether you believe it or not, it's there. And the only thing that is blocking you, okay, is a whole series of things, of fears and self-centeredness and dishonesty patterns. They're all basically, it really boils down to, you know, love and service to become a loving person and so forth. But we need to examine ourselves to find out. I needed to examine myself, but I needed to become willing. First, I had to admit that I was hopeless, okay? Then I had to believe that there is a way out if I can find that power. And then I have to become willing in the third step that I'm willing to do whatever it takes to find that power. You don't find the power in two, okay? You just become that it's going to be there. Then I need to be willing to do what it takes. And there's a lot of prayer involved and all of that and asking God to help us and so forth. But God makes no hard terms for anybody who seeks Him. There's no question about it. First of all, God is within you already, in my belief, and it's only your blocking of self, ego, that is preventing that. And we need to eventually bring conscious mind, ego, into heart, and eventually then when those two collide and they agree and form a love, the explosion that will occur in you will be the fourth dimension, is what Bill Wilson talks about. Because then God will say, I have a vessel, and He's going to work through you to help other people. Because eventually that's the goal. We need to help other people. So what we do is once we find this message, okay, which is, I am powerless, I need to find a power greater than myself, I need to be willing to do that work to find that power, and then eventually I need to start telling other people, you need to become willing to find that power. You need to find a power greater than yourself. And when you do that, that's when God takes over. And it's not you anymore. Now, the beauty, the issue of life, which we'll talk about later on in the other steps, is we have a tendency to fall asleep. You know what I mean? We tend to fall asleep. You know, we get awakened, and then we fall asleep. We get the new car, we get this, we get that, blah, blah, blah. That becomes more important. And next thing you know, you're nodding off, and you're not helping. I don't need to help people that much anymore. You know, I got mine. It was enough in the beginning. What do I have to be doing it? No. This is a daily reprieve, okay? We need to smile. We need to be happy. We need to help people. And that's a lifetime mission. God wants to use you to help other people. So no matter where you are on the journey, whether you've hit a high bottom, low bottom, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. That can be enough for you. And then you need to turn around and try to help other people. Thanks a lot.